friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula Gordon. I want you to meet Dr. Sue Savage Rumbaugh. She's a scientist and one of the world's leading ape language researchers. Dr. Savage Rumbaugh and her research associates at Georgia State University's Language Research Center have taught bonobo chimpanzees to communicate in English. The humans talk. Since chimp vocal cords don't create human sounds, the bonobo chimpanzees, named Kanzi and Pambanisha, use a computer keyboard with lexigram symbols. Our future now includes talking to the animals and the animals talking back. It's no surprise that in the course of this astonishing work, Dr. Savage Rumbaugh and her colleagues have learned a great deal about how human language works. They've addressed some basic questions like, where does meaning come from when we communicate? Does meaning come from the words themselves, or the context, of which words are only one small part?
We're processing the whole implications of that context. So when I overlay some words on it, it makes sense. But if you had those words in isolation, they would make no sense. And that's what scientists typically try to do. They try to teach words in isolation as though the meaning was somehow packed inside the word and had nothing to do with anything else. And we think because we can look up words in a dictionary that the meanings reside in the words, not in the interactions between the people. And that's a big mistake.
It's a mistake Kanzi and Pambanisha sure don't make. And since humans and chimps share 99% of the same DNA, we have lots to learn from this week's remarkable show. Do stay with us. Sue Savage Rumbaugh, we sit in the midst of the woods at the Georgia State University Language Research Center, and I'm going to go for the grown-up question first. You're a scientist. You've been spending a lifetime working with primates. What is it you want to know? What is it that has put you on a lifetime search? What's the question? Never mind what the answer is. We can get to the answer. What's the question that has intrigued you so?
Well, there is a question I started with, and there's a question that I ended with, and they're not the same question.
Interesting.
The question that I started with was, how does our human mind develop the way it does? Why are some people aggressive under all circumstances? Why are some people happy and pleasant under all circumstances? Why can some people learn easily and other people can't? And since apes are our closest living relatives and they share 99% of our DNA...
Okay, you just went blasting past that, but I don't think people really know that apes share 99% of our DNA. We really are biologically virtually identical. Yes? 99%?
That's true. We're at least as identical, for example, as, say, a zebra and a horse. We're
wow.
That close. And zebras and horses can potentially interbreed, and probably so could humans and apes, although we don't do that kind of research here.
No.
And it hasn't been done to my knowledge,
uh-huh.
But we are very, very similar. Blood transfusions can go between the two species. And, of course, heart transplants have been done from chimpanzee to human, although I don't recommend
that
either.
Well, and then we start talking about ethical issues. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Okay, you looked at the great apes, as they are known, other primates, because you're interested in humans. That's where you started.
That's where I started, because we really can't ethically do experiments with humans. We can't take children and raise them in a particular way to see what kind of personality we end up with. But you, at the time we began work with apes, you could raise them in different circumstances. And also you could watch them in the wild. You could watch them in situations which we would say for human beings are uninhibited. You know, we only watch human beings on the bus or on television.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really watch what human beings do in all kinds of circumstances. And we certainly don't watch human development or really what happens with infants in families. We
mm-hmm.
don't really do that.
Mm-hmm.
But with a group of apes, you can
you
watch
mean
them.
With the scientist hat on.
With the scientist hat on, we might bring them into our lab and do a 10-minute or an hour observation
yeah.
of mother-infant or father-infant relationships. We don't go watch what at happens at home 24 hours
yeah.
a day.
And so that
so
path?
With apes, you can watch the whole thing. You can watch the temper tantrums. You can watch the discipline. You can watch the subtle teaching that goes on.
Within an ape family, for
within
instance?
Within an ape family or within an ape group. You can watch the whole dynamics of the group. And in captivity, our initial research was to raise some chimpanzees with exposure to language and other chimpanzees without exposure to language to see how they learned language and to see how language affected the development of mind and development of thought. Now, you certainly can't take two children and rear them without language and two children with language to ask that question. So that was my initial question, but I think it's changed to really now a fascination with not only how the human mind develops, but how mind develops.
Mind. And a much M-I-N-D.
M-I-N-D.
How mind develops. Well, is that, are you just saying brain? Are you just saying how does it grow? When you
no.
say how mind develops, what does that mean? You obviously have something in mind when you say mind.
Well, how we interpret the world around us, how we decide what to do from one minute to the next, how we decide what makes sense, how we're going to respond to our environment. Can we interpret that the people over there are friends or they are dangerous? How should we respond to them?
And there, I can just hear people listening saying, well, fine, but what does an ape have to do with that? They don't do those things. They're not like us. They're not human. They don't have minds. They're animals. They're dumb beasts.
Well, we've placed animals in that category now for pretty much all of recorded history. And it's easy to do that because we need animals as dumb beasts. And it's also easy to do that because we live in cities.
Need them as dumb beasts?
Well, we eat them. We do biological research with them. We wear them. We do all these kinds of things with animals that we would not do with other human beings.
And then there, of course, comes the question of, should we? But we're not there yet. We don't have to do that yet.
As long as we think they don't have minds, we don't have to ask, should we?
Mm-hmm.
It's a non-question. So it's a comfortable answer for us, and it's certainly one that I took for granted initially. I assumed that the dogs and the animals I encountered when I was young were interesting and that they had emotions, but I didn't think that they could go to school and learn things and grow up and have a society with rules and mores the way we do as humans, the things we identify as being human.
Have you changed your mind?
Yes, I've totally changed my mind.
And it will help me, and I have a sense that you're using mind in a technical way.
Well, I used mind two different ways there.
Yeah.
My mind and right. then mind right. in the general sense.
Define the two for us.
The mind, I think one is just the standard usage, what I have in mind. But the other is help us, what is your definition or the standard definition within the sciences? What do we call a mind?
Well, it's one of the things we can't put in a computer right now. It's common sense. It's basically how one makes sense of the world around them, their relationship to the other human beings or creatures that they interact with, or even the computers. How I decide it's appropriate for me to sit here and do a radio interview. How I'm me.
Mm-hmm. The distinction between mind and consciousness, because most of us have trouble
drawing
those lines.
Well, many people
lines.
View animals as not having a me, not having a consciousness. They view an animal as totally responsive to the environment. If I am an animal and I feel hunger, I eat. If I'm an animal and I hear a noise, I react to it. I don't think. I hear a noise. What will happen if I react to that noise? What could have made that noise? Not only what could have made that noise, why was that noise made, and is it supposed to have any implications for me, and am I supposed to do something about it? And the way you answer all those questions depends on your rearing and the culture you've been in, as well as the noise you hear, not just the noise you hear. If you're a human being, science has viewed the reaction of animals as just being dependent on the noise that they hear and a conditioning or an instinctual response to the noise they hear, both of which requires no thought, that the animal's not going over multiple alternatives.
And that's stimulus response. I think we've all kind of grown up with this concept. Oh, well, it's just stimulus response. There's no thinking going on. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and one pretty much has to have a mind to think. What else do you think with? And that mind that's thinking has a set amount of knowledge that it's gained, and it's weighing all that knowledge every moment and deciding what it's going to do next, the body that it lives in, what that body's going to do next.
And are you saying that through a lifetime of working in science that you think that the bonobo chimps and the troglodytes chimps And these other primates have minds that they think?
To me, now it's no longer even a potential question. They think in ways that sometimes are more complicated than I can think or that I can even keep track of. When I began,
that will be very shocking to some people. Have you found that it is shocking to the scientific community that you think this?
Well, if it's...
I said it with a straight face, Sue. I did.
If it's shocking, then people just think that I'm one of those screwy people who just is an animal lover and out in space.
And blow you off.
And so it no longer shocks them because they put me in their common sense tells them to put, their mind tells them to put me in a category that doesn't matter, and so I cannot shock them.
Oh.
Does
However.
That, has that happened?
Yes, because most people have not had 25 years of experience with apes 8 to 10 hours a day. I've had more experience interacting and socially being appropriate with apes and thinking with apes, actually, than I have with humans. I often feel very out of place at cocktail parties and things like that because I haven't spent enough of my adult life doing it to kind of know how you're supposed to do it. But I know exactly what you're supposed to do at a party with apes, and most people are out of place there. But either one takes skill, and I've had to develop that skill, and I've had to think in order to develop that skill, just like I would if I were to go to a cocktail party at Georgia State, and I had to think how to react to everybody appropriately mm-hmm. and know their position and know what was okay to say and not say.
It sounds like you're at the very least on the frontiers. And assuming that to be the case, I would also assume that the question, the general question is, are you doing good science? And I'm sure that those people who write you off and categorize you as, you know, somewhere on the lunatic fringe can rationalize that by saying you're not doing good science and raising all sorts of objections. Obviously, you believe that you're doing good science. Do you engage with those people, or have you just sort of decided to do what you're doing and do the best science, and those who come around will come around, or do you still engage and try to convince those people who threw you into the fringe group?
Well, I've spent about 10 years of very difficult attempts to engage. I've found that when you try to establish a dialogue, you're often shut out by simple mechanisms saying, first of all, you're a female and you're just attached to these animals, so I don't really need to give any credence. Even if your science looks good, we know at basis there must be something you're hiding that makes it wrong. And so you can't
trivializing
reason.
You.
Trivializing
you. Trivializing is an ad hominem argument.
Is one tactic.
Ad hominem?
Yeah. And attacking the person rather than the data.
Uh-huh.
And when you are attacked in that way, you can do such things as invite people to the lab to see for themselves, and generally they will refuse to come. I really haven't had anyone come and refuse to see, although I suppose that could happen. Generally, they just even refuse to come.
Mm. This is scientists who refuse to expose themselves to new information?
They don't even want to see the chimps themselves.
In fairness, in that context, the wonderful work that Thomas Kuhn did in the history of science, the shifting of a paradigm, and that's part of what you're talking about.
This is a new way of seeing.
A major shift is extraordinarily difficult for those practitioners of the old way of seeing. I mean, this is going back a long, long way to the heliocentric, geocentric views of, you know, whether the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun.
Is the earth flat?
So this is not altogether shocking. You're not the first person to have come up with a new idea and be persecuted. Or let us say not so much persecuted, but, you know,
less than appreciated, perhaps.
People didn't enthusiastically embrace your new view of things.
So that is one response that you get, is that people either dismiss you or don't want to talk about it or put you in a place that they don't have to let you be a part of the game.
That's true. And they will say, there's no need to come to your lab because if it's science, how can people actually have to come and see for themselves? Everyone in the world can't do that. Science has to prove things with numbers and facts. And your numbers and facts are not trustworthy because you have an emotional attachment to the animals. And you have to eliminate that and show that the animals can do this when they're not with you.
We're going to come back in just a moment, and we're going to talk about science and about chimps and about changing the world and a worldview that we've lived with for a very long time, at which we are the center. Bill Russell's here. I am Paula Gordon. Here is the Georgia State University Language Research Center. Our guest is Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, and we're going to be right back. Do stay with us.